Open Floor is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy sports with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code OPENFLOOR at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your ticket, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code OPENFLOOR for $20 off your first purchase.
I want Kobe to finally like kind of exhale and say, all right, I had my time. I've got all these young kids here. D'Angelo Russell needs some mentoring. Julius Randle needs mentoring. I need to be, you know, I hate that facilitator word because it gets overused, but be out there. He's a really smart player. Kobe knows the right play to make every time. Doesn't always do it because he, you know, it's the whole trust myself more than others. I'd like to see him just settle into that role where he's just being the elder statesman, still making big shots the way we've seen Paul Pierce do, still taking over at times when necessary, but understanding that, you know, his body's not going to let him be 27-year-old Kobe anymore.
Welcome back inside the Sports Illustrated podcast studio for episode 2 of Open Floor, the NBA podcast. We are rocking and rolling here inside the Time and Life building in Midtown Manhattan, and we have a pretty good podcast for you, if I don't say so myself. Kyle Lowry, the Toronto Raptors point guard, he's going to join us in a few minutes. And Howard Beck, the esteemed writer from Bleacher Report, he's going to stop by the studio and talk a little Knicks, Nets, and a few other things with us as well. But, you know, this NBA season is going to be this NBA season will be a lot about the Cleveland Cavaliers and can they end an extended championship drought in that city. And inside this office, we happen to have a former Cleveland resident, Mark Bechtel, the SI Kids managing editor. He also doubles as the SI NBA editor. You can check out the SI Kids NBA preview issue, which is on stands right now, as well as our own NBA preview issue. And it's always good to get a guy like Cleveland Mark here in the studio. So Mark, welcome to our podcast cave. Let's talk Cleveland here. You're home
for a while.
You are to give some context here. You're that Cleveland fan. You're that guy. You're obsessed with everything Cleveland sports, Indians, Browns. You were screaming when the Browns didn't draft Johnny Manziel. You screamed for joy when they did.
That's going to work out. That is still going to, the jury is still out.
You're still a believer in Johnny Manziel. Okay.
It's the only jersey I've ever bought.
You were also very upset back in the day when Carlos Boozer left town. I mean, that was a sad day for you.
There were a lot of, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people leave town is kind of the thing. And people in Cleveland are really, you know, if somebody decides they want to come to Cleveland, then they're like automatically a hero. And, you know, Boozer just did some, his path out of town was interesting.
You said he lied to a blind man.
He tricked him. He played a trick on a guy who couldn't see.
You paraded around the office for a long time saying he lied to a blind man.
He tricked him. Where's the fun in that, you know? But good for him.
All right. So now you have a year where, what is it, 1954? Was that the last
1964.
Year? 1964. 64, sorry. You have a year now where Cleveland, prohibitive favorites right now, you have to say, to win the NBA championship.
I would think so. That's what it says on SI Kids.
It does.
I believe it
says that in SI the magazine as well, the NBA preview issue. What does that mean for Cleveland to have a team like this that's this close to winning a championship?
They've been prohibitive favorites before.
So skepticism.
Yeah, there's always skepticism. I mean, the Indians were the best team in baseball, you know, one of the two or three best. And for a couple of years, it was pretty obvious that, you know, they were pretty close to unmatched. And, you know, that never worked out. The Browns had 2 years where they lost the AFC championship. So you would think, oh, all right, these guys are probably the favorite. So, you know, it hasn't been 51 years of just horrible play. There have been some good years in there and it's never panned out. And so, yeah, you sort of wonder what's going to happen and make it not work out.
Would a championship by the Cavs mean as much as any other franchise?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're definitely, you know, if the Browns won the Super Bowl, the place would go nuts and a World Series would be almost as big as that. But at this point, you're not, you know, now people are sort of looking back and retroactively saying, you know, well, if we counted the Cleveland force of the Major Indoor Soccer League, then the, you know, then it's only been like 22 force? Years. You know, you could. You could. They played at Richfield. They played at the same place the Cavs played. They actually outdrew them 1 year, I think. So, yeah. I actually had the same thing last year. Yeah, it was last year. Vanderbilt won the College World Series, and I went to Vanderbilt. And, you know, I've never won a championship in anything as a fan, so I was, you know, wondering if that counted, if my streak was over. And I decided it did. So.
Were you okay with the fact they lost in the finals last year? Did the injuries and all this stuff?
I didn't think they were going to win the finals anyways, just because I figured it would say, you know, kind of take time for things to gel and everybody to get used to playing with each other. And there were, you know, a lot of guys in new roles. And, you know, unfortunately, they didn't – it would have been nice if they had at least been healthy and been able to play together and lost. It was just – I don't think getting that experience of playing in the finals where it's basically 5-on-1 really helped anybody – learn anything at all. But I didn't go in, like I said, I didn't go in with huge expectations. I kind of figured, you know, winning the East wouldn't be that tough, but winning the finals was going to be hard.
How quickly did you forgive LeBron? Did you welcome the day he signed?
The second he signed, yeah. Like I said, I mean, a lot of players in Cleveland, it's a lot of, you know, a big part of the story of this heartbreak, this 5 decades of heartbreak is just people leaving town. And anytime somebody says, I want to come back, you know, you're going to be forgiven. And, you know, Kenny Lofton got traded to the Braves and then he came back to the Indians and it was sort of a great deal. They ended up basically loaning him out for a year. They got David Justice, then Lofton came back and that sort of made Lofton a hero. He was like, look, I want to come back to this place. And, you know, there are some abandonment issues, I think, in Cleveland. You know, the Browns just up and left and, you know, you just sort of expect, all right, you know, nobody wants to come here. It's the butt of jokes. And for LeBron, you know, obviously it helps that LeBron's the best player on the planet too. But yeah, I think it was pretty easy to overlook that little 4 year period.
What was the toughest beat for you? You know, with so many, they've become the drive, the fumble, etc. I mean, what was the one for you?
The drive.
Yeah.
The drive was just brutal. And the fumble too, the fumble was a weird game because they were getting killed and then they came back.
Right.
They cut it to 38-31 and they fumbled. And actually what very few people remember is after the fumble, Denver took a safety after they recovered it. So it was 38-33. And then the Browns actually got the ball back and were sort of in Hail Mary range. And, that was kind of a double whammy, but I think the drive was the worst because for me that was the first one. The 97 World Series actually might have been worse now that I think about it, because that was one they had, you know, they're 3 outs from a championship and a guy who hasn't blown a save all year comes in and blows a save. So that might have been worse. I was listening to it on the radio because I wanted to hear the Cleveland broadcast if they won, and I was watching it on TV, and I remember I started to think maybe the radio was a bad idea, so I shut it off, and then I was just watching it on TV, and in extra innings, the game-winning hit up the middle. I turned the TV off, like, right after he hit it, because you could tell it was going up the middle. And then I kind of, you know, I'm sitting on the floor of my apartment all by myself, you know, basically weeping. And then I realized, you know what, I never really saw the ball land. I never saw the guy touch the plate, so I, like, turned the TV back on to – you know, hopefully see the game still going on. And they were celebrating in the clubhouse and I didn't speak to anybody for like a week.
See, I felt that pain as a Boston guy, Red Sox going through what they did.
We'll never complain about anything.
The Red Sox drought was as bad as any out there.
It was, but like then the Red Sox win and then everybody goes, you know, everybody's like, just one, and then I'll never ask for anything again. Yeah. And then the next year it just turns into this.
Cleveland people would be the exact same way. You win this year, you're gonna start looking towards next year by mid-July.
Sure. Maybe. We'll see.
Is this the year for the Cavs?
Are you not
allowed to have optimism because of the history?
Yeah. No, you have to have some optimism. Otherwise, you know, why do you get up in the morning?
But I don't know. I have a hard time.
Really, there are times where I just don't. But, you know, just trying to look at it from a, you know, sort of dispassionate point of view. Yeah, they're the best team in the East. They should win the East with no problem. You just never know what that you know, what they're going to be up against in the finals. You just sort of hope whoever wins the West is going to get a lot taken out of them. You know, last year, Golden State just had a great – they just had a great little run. Everything just went – everything broke perfectly for them. And you just kind of hope that's not going to happen this year. You hope that, you know, it's going to be a huge dogfight out in the West and somebody, you know, maybe you come in and you're well rested and the other guys had a rough ride this time. So
what's your biggest fear about this season? Is it an injury to LeBron? Is it Kevin Love not fitting in again? Is it the second unit? Because the whole team, I mean, it's hard to look at that team and not see the face. I mean, Anderson Varejão is back. Yeah, I've forgotten about Anderson Varejão.
Yeah. It's going to be tough just fitting the pieces together. And, but yeah, you know, you wonder when LeBron is going to start to slow down. And, you know, if he gets hurt or if his role changes in any way, then that just totally, you know, any little change from him trickles down in every possible direction and everything becomes incredibly different for everyone else. But, you know, barring an injury to him, I think the regular season, they're going to have plenty of time to sort of figure out what goes on. And last year, you know, I was really surprised last year. If you think about like the way the big three works, you got, you know, LeBron, you knew LeBron was just going to do his thing. Love, it seemed like all you were doing is just asking him to be Kevin Love, but just, you know, not as often. You know, it's just sort of do the little pick and pop thing and shoot threes and space the floor. Irving was the one that I thought was going to be a big problem because Irving, you're basically asking a guy who's been a point guard his entire life and always had the ball in his hand and always, you know, there were times where he would just dribble around for 20 seconds and then say, all right, make something happen. Now you're saying, all right, not only are you not going to do that anymore, you're going to have to learn to play basically with another guy who's sort of functioning as the de facto point guard. So you're going to have to learn to play on the wing without the ball. And it's something he'd never done before. He didn't do it in college. He didn't do it in the pros. And he just turned into a really pretty good guy at just scoring off the wing without the ball in his hands all the time. So I thought he was going to be the problem. And I thought Love would fit in, no, you know, without any worries at all. So I think if they can sort of figure out how to get Love in there and just sort of make that balance work a little better, they're going to be in pretty good shape.
What's your level of confidence in David Blatt?
I like the guy. I mean, he's in a tough spot. I mean, you know, he was obviously hired to do a completely different job. When they hired him, LeBron was not in the picture, and if LeBron had been in the picture, I don't think Blatt gets the job. You know, the guy does know how to coach. And that was sort of why the whole thing at the, you know, with the timeout in the Bulls game and then drawing up the play without LeBron, that was sort of surprising because, you know, the guy, if there's one thing he knows how to do, it's coach. I mean, his sort of knowledge of the NBA and how it works and that sort of thing was what you figure he had to learn. But just from an X's and O's standpoint, you know, from a not calling a timeout when you don't have a timeout standpoint, that's where I figured he'd be fine. So I was a little surprised at how that worked out. I think his biggest thing now is, you know, if you're coaching a team who's got LeBron on it, you've got to have a good relationship with him because if somebody's going to go, it ain't going to be him. So if he can get that in a good place with him and LeBron, then I feel good about him. I mean, he's basketball's basketball to a certain extent, and I think he can sort of learn the areas where it isn't, where the NBA is different from the rest of the world. But, you know, the guy knows how to coach, so I feel pretty good about him.
Will you be at the parade? If it takes place,
I will definitely be at the parade.
What will that parade be like?
I don't know. I would probably build a float to go in the parade, or crash a float or something. But you know, there's a lot of Cleveland angst out there. I would have to like fight Joe Posnanski for, you know, that sort of most, or Scott Robb, that, you know, that sort of most tortured Cleveland sports writer gig. So I gotta keep going back and work on that. I gotta up my profile.
Well, you'll be a member of the podcast family here, since you're in the office and you're the Cleveland guy,
the Cleveland Mark,
and you're we'll try to make that nickname catch on, and we'll go from there.
All right, should I get a T-shirt made or anything?
I don't know. Maybe with your head on it, the caricature kind of look. No,
you know, Cleveland is like, it's like the indie T-shirt capital of the world.
There you go.
They have a ton of T-shirts. There's one call. Yeah, there's. Well, actually, I don't want to say the name on the air because they're not paying us yet. But I think we can make some things happen.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us there, Mark.
Anytime.
All right.
Austin, Chris.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, the Raptors are one of the teams to contend with in the Eastern Conference this year. We'll talk to one of their best players, all-star point guard Kyle Lowry, when we come back. Sports fans have never had more options than they do now, and that includes a reinvention of fantasy sports. You've probably heard of FanDuel. And if you want to try it out on basketball, football, hockey, or baseball, use my code OPENFLOOR at FanDuel.com for up to $200 in bonus cash. Here's what FanDuel is all about. It's daily fantasy sports where you can win cash and there's no waiting for payment. Winners get paid the same night of their victory. There's no long drafts, and you pick your team in minutes with a salary cap format. There are thousands of open leagues every day of the 15-16 NBA season. There's no season-long commitment, and league entries start at just $1. Over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. If you love watching games, FanDuel ups the ante and adds a whole new dimension to the fan experience. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code OPENFLOOR and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code OPENFLOOR today, so don't get left out. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Try it out today. Let's bring in Kyle Lowry, all-star point guard for the Toronto Raptors. Kyle was on something of a scoring binge early in the preseason, and Kyle joins me here on the podcast. Is that a sign of things to come, Kyle? Are we going to see you putting up like 30 a night this year?
No, nothing. It's just, you know, whatever happens in the flow of the game and whatever my team needs from me, that's what you're going to see that on a night-to-night basis.
It felt pretty good, though, right? Dropping 40 every so often?
That's preseason, so, I mean, if you're doing it in a regular season, then definitely cool, but preseason, it doesn't really matter.
You guys last year put up one more regular season win. You won the Atlantic again, but did you feel like a better team last year than the year before as you went into the playoffs?
I think we just kind of, you know, I don't know how our team, you know, we went into kind of a, you know, we came into that final stretch of not winning, you know, so many games, and we were kind of on a little bit of a slump. So I don't think we went into the postseason as strong as, you know, we could have.
I mean, does it matter how you get knocked out? 2 years ago was 7 games with Brooklyn. Last year was a 4-game sweep. Is one worse than the other, or is it both like, damn, we got beat?
They both suck. You know, both of them are, I mean, honestly, just both. At the end of the day, you lost and you didn't send home. So it worse is what, you know, you lose 4 games, you go home. You lose 4 games, you go home. It sucks.
What was on your mind this offseason? I mean, were you thinking about how the team was going to get better for yourself? What were you thinking about as far as you getting better?
Well, I just wanted to make sure I came in at the best possible way to be the effective the longevity of the season and the grind. And I think our team, you know, with the way our management, they do things and they just try to make our team better and make sure we put ourselves in winning positions.
Did you expect there to be some changes before this season?
Yeah, for sure. I did. You know, but that's one thing I expected. But at the end of the day, I can't make those calls. You know, I don't make those calls. So I got to do what they tell me to do and go with what they go with. And I support the organization.
You guys were a top 10 defensive team a couple of years ago, fell into the bottom third last year. We all know the numbers. What happened there? Was it just because you guys tried to play at a faster pace offensively? Did you see some drop off with how you guys were playing defensively?
I think we just we knew we could outscore guys, and sometimes we just relied on that. But at the end of the day, you know, we just had to – I don't think we focused as much and concentrated on the defensive end that we wanted to do, what we should have.
Dwayne Casey has said that defense and focusing on it has been a priority in the preseason and training camp. What does that mean exactly?
No, we've been doing defense every day, all day, every day, all day for the last month. But it's been good, and that's what his philosophy is, and that's what we got to go with.
Are there schemes – you guys are going to do differently this year, new schemes you're bringing in? I know you brought Andy Greer in on the assistant coaching staff. What schematically is going to be different with how you play?
Well, I just think we're going to be a lot more aggressive defensively and do things and, you know, not be a reaction team.
You guys brought Damari Carroll in, probably the biggest signing you've had there, really since you got there, actually. Now, what have you seen from him in the first couple of weeks?
Well, DC's going to be a guy who's going to keep the defense. You know, he's going to guard the best player. He's going to keep us, our team together. He's going to make plays. He's going to make shots. So, you know, it's just it's a learning process with us all.
Who does that help on this team? I mean, does it help guys like DeMar? You see Terrence probably going to the bench. I mean, what's the trickle-down effect for DeMar coming there?
Well, I think it helps guys and put them in the right position. I think it gives guys like James Johnson a guy to, you know, kind of – see what he's doing to make sure he can mimic and try to get him on the floor and do some things to help us defensively. I think it puts Terrence in a position where he can, be a little bit more of an offensive threat. I think it puts DeMar in his right position to be an offensive threat. I think it just helps everybody.
Do you get a little bit of extra joy out of not only getting a guy like Damari, but also taking him from a team that was a competitor with you last year?
At the end of the day, I didn't do nothing. He just chose to sign with a different team. He got paid and he came on over.
It's a nice life. Of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, for sure.
Offensively, as the point guard, this team was really good in terms of efficiency last year. We've all heard about, can you improve the ball movement this year? What do you take on as the point guard with improving the ball movement?
Well, I mean, just we got to play better and, be a little bit more unselfish and, play smoother, play faster. But, it's some things you just got to fill out. It's some things you just can't predict. You got to go out there and still play.
Why did it seem like the ball? I mean, it's a weird thing because you guys were so good offensively last year, but with, I think the passing was 24th or 25th. Why was there such a gap there?
I honestly couldn't tell you that. You got to go back and watch the film. At the end of the day, I just was playing.
I want to go back to Damari and just you playing with him. How is he going to help you specifically?
Well, I think Damari just gives me a guy who's going to cut and save me from bad shots and be there and be able to put himself in situations where he can get open jump shots and, he can help a little bit on defense and just a little bit more communication.
Is it helpful having a guy that's, now been deep into the playoffs, another guy with playoff experience on the roster?
Yeah, I always ask to the team's competitive nature and our team, how we can get better as a group and grow.
The big thing with you this offseason, and we all saw the pictures and we've seen you in training camp with the weight loss. I mean, was that a goal of yours? Did that just happen just because you got in better shape?
I mean, it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be effective from start to finish. So I think that this should help me.
How much different do you feel out there?
I feel a little bit different, but let's get the season up on way and let's check in 25, 30 games and do it.
You bring in a guy like Corey Joseph to back you up at that spot. What have you seen from him? Is he going to help you in some ways?
I think Corey's going to be a real solid addition for us. He'll be a good backup. He got some championship pedigree and he knows what he's doing out there.
My question with Toronto almost every year is this the year we're going to see Jonas Valanciunas have a big offensive year? He's a rebounder. He's physical. We know what he's got on that side. But is this the year, do you think, we see him take another step forward offensively?
I think as the older he gets, the better he's going to be. I think, we still got to go out there and play our game and play to our strengths and, and do things to help our team win. And if he comes in and be a bigger part of the offense, then that's great.
Do you actively try as the point guard to get him more involved?
Yeah, we always want our big to be effective and do things to try to help our team win. So, it just depends on how the game's going and how the flow is going.
Now, we picked you guys number two in the Eastern Conference.
Oh, man, I appreciate it. We just got to back it up now.
do you feel a lot better going to this year? I know every year, optimism, everyone's optimistic, but do you feel better about this team or differently about this team than maybe the last two?
Well, I think we're going to be better defensively. That's one thing, and I think that's what we're going to hang our hats on. So I think if we can bank on that, I think we'll be better.
Well, Kyle, I appreciate it, my man. Best of luck this season. Hopefully another all-star nod for you and another good year for Toronto.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right. That's Kyle Lowry, Raptors all-star point guard. We'll take a break. When we come back, Howard Beck from Bleacher Report will join us here in the podcast studio. Fall is here, and that means one thing for all the hoop heads. The NBA season is back on. LeBron and the Cavs, Steph Curry and the Warriors, the Spurs, the Rockets, who else is going to show up this year? When you show up to the arena, use the SeatGeek app and my code OPENFLOOR to get a $20 rebate. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free and takes less than a minute to download. Then you search for your event, find the deal you want, enter our code OPENFLOOR, and when you complete your purchase, SeatGeek will send you a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. Even if you pick a seat that's less than $20, they'll still send you a full check. That means SeatGeek is paying you to use their service. SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online and shows you the best deal automatically. They also have this cool feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with a value score and plots the best deals on a color-coded map of the venue. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. You can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can make the purchase with two quick taps of your phone. So to redeem your promo code and get your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app today, enter promo code OPENFLOOR in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to see the NBA, the NFL, or how about the Mets and Royals in the World Series, use the SeatGeek app and enter our code OPENFLOOR to save $20. Speaking of the World Series, my colleagues Ted Keith and Steve Canella have baseball fans covered on their show, The Strike Zone. Go inside the 2015 World Series with expert views on the Royals and Mets, who are, weirdly, winners of the 85 and 86 World Series, respectively. In 86, I was watching the ball go through Bill Buckner's legs. Tough year for me. The Strike Zone podcast, search for it on iTunes or visit si.com/podcast. Let's bring in a guy who makes the best 1 minute videos of anybody in the business.
2 minutes. And some are two.
2 minutes. He's also a pretty good writer too. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer over Bleacher Report. And are you still a radio host? Is that?
I have been a radio host. I am hoping that I will again be a radio host on Bleacher Report Radio on Sirius XM. But we're going to pick that up back in about midseason.
You got to search for your replacement, right? Ethan Skolnick has moved on to greener pastures. Skolnick-Beck duo.
It was dynamic as it was. Exactly. What better way to start your Sunday morning than Skolnick and Beck on the radio? But Ethan's moved on to bigger, better things. And so, yeah, I need I'm in the market for a new partner.
Well, you guys got LeBron. You were one of the few people that got LeBron to do a call-in radio show.
All credit to Ethan on that one, man. And it was awesome. And it was great. And LeBron was really good, too, by the way. Like, that was the thing. Like, oh, we're going to get him? Okay, great. But you never know. I mean, you know, the guys, they get in that zone, as we know. There's the media version of themselves. And I thought we got real LeBron that day. He was very relaxed. You could just see what the effects of a couple of weeks outside of that environment, not just basketball and all the pressures, but not dealing with all of us and the media scrums and everything. I felt like we got Dad LeBron that day. You hear the kids in the background. He was just very relaxed. It was cool.
Who's your favorite guy to interview?
Favorite guy to interview? I mean, over the years, it was often Kobe. And I know we all talk about now, like, we've got this, like, new crazy letting it all hang out
Grandpa
version of
Kobe.
Yeah, who just, you know, he wants all the kids off his lawn and he'll say anything about any subject any day. He always was more prone to that than not anyway. I think he has reached a new level of just letting it all hang out. But, I mean, he was even in his prime, you know, aside from some tough years, you know, there were some years there where he had to pull back a little bit. He was always a guy who was very engaging anyway. Like, Kobe wasn't all pre-programmed. And I feel like we've got a generation of players now who have come in who I feel like, and LeBron was this way for most of his career. I think he's gotten better. I felt like LeBron from day one was boring. And that had nothing to do with his play. It had to do with this persona that he was putting on in front of the media where I thought he was very calculated. And calculating is not interesting, you know? No. You want to see the real guy. So Paul Pierce has become phenomenal. I mean, I think, again, a guy who probably always was, but is even better the
get
last couple of years.
Get off my lawn.
Dude, yeah.
Get a little older.
I want all the get off my lawn guys. If I could just talk to them every day.
I tell you who's not, and maybe it's a little bit different this year because he's headed to free agency, but Kevin Durant has always been good.
Yeah.
This year, I would imagine it's going to be different just because he doesn't want to answer all this stuff about free agency over and over again, but in the past, if you wanted to grab Kevin Durant and talk to him for 10 minutes about any subject, he would answer pretty authentically. And I always appreciated that.
Yeah, I feel like that has been one of the things that's endearing about him. And I think that among the current superstars, the guys who have emerged over the last, you know, 5 years especially, that Durant's a guy that some of the reasons I think that people gravitate toward him, whether it's as teammates or as media fans, you always do feel like you're getting the genuine Durant. He may not always say the most, you know, spectacular things. He's not going to be real controversial or whatever, but he does seem to actually say what is on his mind. And it feels genuine. It feels real. It doesn't feel calculated. But he has pulled back. I just spent a week out there to do a story on him, and I could not get him because Kevin Durant right now is refusing essentially all one-on-ones, even for a minute or two, because I think he's really kind of very wary. And I don't blame him, but he's very wary of the free agency, topic and all the energy around it, the speculation around it. And again, it's understandable. I get it. It's unfortunate that he wants to pull himself back a little bit because I do think he's one of the more engaging and grounded stars in this league.
When did we become a media podcast? We just did those like 5 minutes on interviews. And where's Deitch? Is he here? Is he doing this interview?
You're encroaching on his ground.
I think I am.
Is he going to start doing NBA now?
Well, he's welcome to it. It's plenty of meat on the bone there. All right, let's start in New York because we're both here. You've covered the Knicks before, covered the Nets as well. I want to start with the Knicks because I think I picked them 13th this year, and maybe I'm off by a place or two, but I don't see them making the playoffs. Is this team any better in year two of Carmelo than they were in year one?
See, here's the thing. Last year's being evaluated through the wrong prism. And also the idea that, well, they were a 17-win team. 30 would be a big leap. And, you know, 40 is impossible. We can't look at it in those terms because, one, it's like a 98% new team. And two, the reason that they were as bad as they were last year, historically bad, wasn't just because Phil screwed this up or this happened, that happened. It was because Carmelo played half the season with a bad knee, and the other half the season he did not play at all because he got surgery on the bad knee. So just getting, and granted, Carmelo Anthony doesn't play 82 game seasons. He plays maybe 70, 75 if you're lucky. But just whatever a full season of Carmelo is, alone, with a competent cast around him, has to be worth 30 to 32 minimum because he's still that good. And so as long as Carmelo's Carmelo and he's playing 70-something games, I started a base of 30 to 32 wins. Then it becomes, you know, can Aaron Aflalo be the guy he was 2 years ago instead of last season? Can he stay healthy?
Already hurt.
Already hurt. And that's a concern for certain. You know, how much do they get out of guys like, you know, Jaren Grant, who's a rookie, but an older rookie? You know, he's what, 23 or whatever. So he's veteran-ish for a rookie. You know, how much does Porzingis do as a rookie? I don't think you can expect a ton. But, you know, Kyle O'Quinn is a guy with some upside that a lot of people around the league like. But how much can you rely on him? Derek Williams just had this phenomenal preseason.
I'm not riding the Derek Williams bandwagon. And when Sacramento waves goodbye to you, that's when I draw the line.
And I'm not suggesting anybody should jump on that bandwagon, but there's a reason he was in the number two pick a few years ago. We can all fall into that trap, of course. But, you know, and
he was called the Hashim Thabeet trap.
Yeah. But he was with, I mean, look, come on, in fairness, he left the Kings. When the Kings throw you out, that's often a bad sign. On the other hand, it's the Kings. Maybe they were not exactly the best environment for bringing the best out of Derek Williams.
Yeah, maybe they made a mistake or two along the way.
Yeah, so anyway, I just think that there are if everything breaks right for the Knicks, maybe they get up into the high 30 wins, but I think 500 is a stretch because they have just no depth and no room for error. They're not a playoff team. I do think they're moving in the right direction. I liked their offseason.
You covered Phil Jackson extensively as a coach out in L.A. Did you see him as someone that could, you know, graduate into a front office role? And what do you make of what he's done in the first year and a half on the job?
One of the things that he said early on, and I can't remember in what context this came up, but this was during my beat days in LA, where he had talked about and had said, and friends of his had told me too, like he was never going to be a GM type because GMs have to work 12 months out of the year. Not that coaches don't work the off season, but it's not the same as what a GM does. He didn't want to be a guy poring over spreadsheets and the salary cap. Didn't want to be a guy dealing with agents who would, but you know, that's that he had his own sense of where his place was, not because he couldn't do it. But I also think that, one, the door on coaching just slammed shut on him in a way that he had no control over. Physically, he just can't handle the rigors anymore. And he needed to channel himself into something. And I do think that he's a guy who has this broader vision of what a franchise should be about, what an organization should be about, the kinds of players you want, the philosophy, whether it's, you know, it's not all just about the triangle. It's just about the kinds of, you know, character you want. We talk about Spurs culture, right? There's a Phil culture that he's trying to create, you know, that I think in his head for years probably said, if I ever had full control, what would I do? What kinds of people would I hire? So I think that there was a natural inclination toward it as long as he didn't have to do all of the other day-to-day stuff. And that's as a team president instead of GM, he has that luxury. Whether it's working or not or will work, I mean, I think it's still too soon. He inherited what was kind of a mess. Last year became a teardown. This is year one of the rebuild. And just as I said it with Donnie Walsh when he was here over and over, you can't judge based on the teardown part. Let's see where it goes once you start building.
Okay. That being said, is it hyperbole to think that Porzingis will kind of define him? Because, you know, Phil, he's on a multi-year contract, but who knows how many years he's going to fulfill in that contract. You mentioned health issues, age. He loves living in Southern California.
Who wouldn't?
Porzingis, you know, We're already seeing guys like Emmanuel Mudiay who could have better first years than Porzingis. Is it hyperbole to suggest that Porzingis and his ability to pan out to the player they believe he can be, will that define him as an executive?
I think that will be a huge part of what ends up defining him as an executive. But I also think that if we take Porzingis out of the equation for a minute, or just what Porzingis becomes, right? Whether he becomes a superstar or not, if sometime in the next 3 to 5 years, based on the moves that Phil Jackson made, not just Porzingis, but Robin Lopez and re-signing Carmelo and drafting Jaren Grant and everything else, if all of those other moves get the Knicks back into 50-win contention at the top of the East again sometime in the next few years, that will define him a lot. And, you know, Porzingis could become, let's say, not a bust, but just a very solid player who's not a superstar. It was like, you know, it's like Gallinari. Gallinari, injuries aside, has become a very, very good player. To the extent that he defined Donnie Walsh's tenure, which was too short, he was still a good pick. He wasn't a superstar. Porzingis taken only a couple spots ahead of that. You don't often get the franchise changer, right? But if you succeed otherwise, if you create a 50-win team and a sustainable one, I think that defines you as much as the pick does. But, you know, we also have to just urge caution on how we judge Porzingis, because remember, you know, guys in year one who look like the stars and then the busts, and then it all kind of evens. Like, you know, Michael Carter Williams, at one point everybody thought, oh, he's going to be great. Now we're kind of wondering a little about him. You know, Brandon Jennings at one point was the guy that every Knicks fan was ruining that they didn't pick. You really want Brandon Jennings now? I mean, he started to come around last season before the injury. I mean, I really thought he was starting to come into his own, but it's taken years. So we got to give these guys a good 3, 4, 5 years before you even realize who they are. Mudiay could go off the charts in year one. It doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be a 10-time All-Star. And Porzingis could really struggle. But a couple of years down the road, as he starts to pack on some muscle and learns the NBA game, he'll be a different guy.
Right. It's not a one-year sort of thing. But I do worry that Mudiay seemed like a pretty natural pick for them. They didn't have a point guard.
Sure.
He's a polished kid. I mean, the triangle, who cares? I mean, I hate the idea of like, well, we're not sure if he can fit into the triangle. If the guy can play basketball, you can make a system work for him. Now, Porzingis, enormous talent. I just think, though, if he winds up being Darko to several other players behind him, that could be what defines Phil. And that's what worries me about this pick. Look, he looks okay. He's going to start, I guess, you know, opening night, which I think is a little weird because you're really giving him a trial by fire and hope it doesn't damage him too much.
I'm worried about that one on a couple levels, right? I see both sides of this. On the one hand, look, he's the pick. He's going to, you know, you want him to help. You want him to be a positive influence from day one. You want to give him also all the experience in the world. Let, you know, throw him into the fire, right? That's the expression. Just let him just see what he can do. On the other hand, yeah, physically, there's the rigors of a very long season. You don't want him to stumble early and have it dent his confidence. It can backfire. And you also, your other moves, as Phil Jackson, Steve Mills, this front office, your other moves were not rebuilding kind of moves. I know we keep calling this a rebuild, but they brought in veterans. Aflalo and Lopez are veterans. Oquuin, a younger veteran, Derek Williams, a younger veteran, but they didn't, this is not an all-out rebuild in the teardown Sixer type thing, or what the Sonics / Thunder did early on, where you just did the lottery year after. That's not that kind of rebuild. They brought in veterans at a high price immediately. So that suggests you want to win now. Porzingis is a long-term project. So I don't know, there's some tension, there's some conflict there. And I think if another guy emerges, it looks better to play Carmelo at the four and they find a way to fill the gap at the three, they do that. Or Kylo Quinn starts at the four, or, you know, Derek Williams continues his great preseason. And
we're
getting
you a Derek Williams jersey. You know that, right? We're getting you a
Williams
jersey.
I'm just saying,
you know,
crazy things happen.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I don't feel bad for Carmelo Anthony. If he wanted to win, he would have gone to Chicago. He had the option. It was clear as day. 4 years, X million. Go to a winner, take the extra year. You know what you signed up for.
Yep.
You have no right to complain anymore. All that being said, do you think the Knicks look to trade him this year? You said best case scenario, kind of 500.
Yeah.
That's not really what you're paying Carmelo Anthony all that money for.
No.
He's not getting any younger. He's coming off a knee injury. If he's healthy at midseason, they're hovering right around 17, 18 wins. Yeah. What do you think the Knicks' approach is with Carmelo?
I think you should be opportunistic at this point. I think that you've already gone partway into a rebuild. You know, the Carmelo contract alone says it's not a rebuild, but they keep trying to have it both ways a little bit. So right now, I think you see how this goes. If at midseason everything's clicking. All those things I said were all of these, you know, best case scenarios. If they're all going best case scenario, maybe you just roll with it and just see where it leads you in the playoffs, because, you know, God only knows these fans here, you know, deserve a little bit of happiness now and then. So you could just roll with that and then reevaluate it next summer. If the team's not doing that well, but he looks like himself again, and there are teams out there that are just clamoring for scoring, if you can make a great opportunistic trade and reload, because again, they don't have their pick next year, you know, not Phil Jackson's fault. That was, again, the previous administration trading away a pick for freaking Bargnani. You know, if you've got an opportunity to reload, to bring back in some youth, some picks, whatever, I don't know that you're going to be contending for a title with Carmelo in the next 3, 4, 5 years anyway. And yes, as you point out, he's 31. He'll be 32 next spring. The window's getting small, and he should feel that too, by the way. And it's why I thought both sides, I've said this many times, both sides made a mistake. He should have walked away, and they should have let him walk.
I don't know if they should have let him walk, just because it wasn't like they would open up a bunch of cap space in the short term, because then they were already...
No, they would have had no cap room at that time, but they would have had more cap room this past summer.
Yeah, they would have had more, but... You know, with Carmelo, I still feel you can get assets for him, especially when you head into the summer of 2016, when there's Durant and then there's a massive drop off when it comes to free agents out there. So Carmelo, if he's that, quote, free agent that's out there you can acquire via trade, all of a sudden that contract, which is bad, but not nearly as bad as some of them are going to look in the next couple of years, I still think he's a tradable guy.
And it's one of the other reasons why I think you don't trade him at midseason, why you go to the summer, because next summer, when nearly every team in the league has cap room, and you know, some fans understand this now and a lot still don't, but cap room helps you make trades a lot more easily, because now you're not having to match salaries.
So absorb bad salaries.
Yeah. Right. You don't have to match anymore. So when everyone's got cap room, when everyone's under the cap, now you can actually try to go talent for talent and try to get a real package back for Carmelo. I mean, I know you never get full value when you trade a star, but you can get a lot closer with the flexibility you'll have in July that you won't have in February.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Isn't it great that Bargnani stayed in New York? Like, just to taunt the Knicks from across the river. Like, when they have to give up
their pick. Who's taunting who? I think the Knicks are probably taunting the Nets for having signed him.
Well, at least the Nets got him for nothing. The Knicks gave up a first-round pick, which could turn out to be a pretty high pick in 2016.
Of the Bargnani mistakes that could be made, the Knicks' mistake with Bargnani is still a much, much more profound mistake.
He took less money to come to the Nets than go to the Sacramento Kings, which says a lot about Sacramento right there. What do you make of what the Nets are now trying to do? It's like, you know, don't pay attention to the last 5 years, what we were doing there, just giving away draft picks, overspending on big salaries. Now we're doing things in a more traditional route. What do you make of what they're now trying to reinvent themselves as?
I think they're doing what they have to do right now. It's the only thing left. You tried this. You went all in. You went all in and doubled and tripled down on the all in idea. And it didn't work. It did create some excitement from day one. Their first goal, especially Prograf's first goal, and this front office, as you know, they had to march to certain orders. And one of those was, when we get to Brooklyn, we got to have stars. We got to be great. We got to take on the Knicks.
Billboard worthy guys.
Right. And you know, Prograf's putting up that billboard of himself across from the Garden, saying blueprint for greatness with him and Jay-Z. They wanted from day one to look like, we're coming into your territory and we're going to steal your fans and we're going to be the number one team in town. Didn't exactly work out that way, but they did make the playoffs a couple years in a row, got to a second round series. It was, a qualified modest amount of success. The problem was the investment made to get that success, all the picks traded away and everything else was, through the roof. It wasn't the great long-term move, but now they are where they are. Darren Williams didn't want to be here. They didn't want him here. It was the right move to buy him out, let him walk, clear the air. They will have cap room next summer. They will be under the luxury tax this year. You can't get the picks back that you traded away for Pearson Garnett or for Joe Johnson, for that matter. All you can do is try to be more judicious in the way you're treating it all now, and they are. They're not going to be great. They're not going to be, I don't think, terrible, but I don't see them as a playoff team right now. But like a lot of teams, they get the get out of jail free card next summer when they have cap room, and it's still an attractive place to play. It is New York, and that is a great building, and they got a new practice facility coming online in the next couple of months. They'll be able to attract guys. Who's going to take the money? And as you note, there's a big drop-off after Durant. I don't think they're in the Durant sweepstakes.
No.
I don't think he's leaving it either, by the way. But the Nets have a lot of kind of, you know, making up for lost time and picks to do.
You mentioned Durant and if he's leaving, and I don't think he's leaving either. One of the subplots of Durant is the tampering that goes out there with him, whether it's – look, you can't legislate players doing that stuff. Players are going to talk to other players and recruit that. But is it an issue for the NBA with, you know, all this – backroom dealing of trying to lure Durant in a variety of different ways? Do you think the NBA can or should do anything more than doing right now to police this stuff?
I think it's very, very, very.
Kind of makes Sam Presti paranoid out there a little bit.
Well, yeah. And no, if you're Sam Presti, any of us in that job, we would instantly become the most paranoid people on earth. And for that matter, if you're anybody in that position who's got a superstar free agent heading toward free agency, the NBA screwed up the way that they modified the CBA the last time through, where extensions are no longer even worth signing if you're a max guy. So you can't lock up a guy early to avoid this scenario. There's no incentive for Durant to sign an extension. If you're Sam Presti, your hands are tied. You just have to get to free agency and hope for the best, and hope that this is really where he wants to be. But on the tampering side of it, I mean, what do you do? You know, everybody knows there's a lot of stuff that goes on, whispering campaigns and just serial contact. You're not directly trying to recruit the guy, but you've got, friend of a friend or associate of an associate who are having these conversations. But how do you rein that in? It's such a murky underworld in a way of the NBA that I don't know how. There are rules against it.
Yeah.
I don't know that any of them have ever been enforced. Yeah. And I think it's very difficult to do.
Plus, you get that reputation as a tattletale if you start guys in
every
for this, that, and the other.
Every GM could start pointing the fingers at each other.
Yeah, it's not good. All right, I want to ask you one question about Kobe. Expect this to be his last year, and if not, what's next for him?
He's really hard to gauge, right? I mean, anybody else who had gone through what he's gone through.
Is he the type of guy to want one of those Derek Jeter-type victory tours? I didn't think Jeter was that type of guy, but he did. And look, if this was Kobe's last year, and if he said it was his last year, he could have one of those travel the NBA, get a piece of the Boston Garden floor, whatever, commemorating his MSG biggest moments. I mean, he is a hard guy to get a read on. He's hard to figure out.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think he needs or wants all that. I think he'd rather have that sixth ring, but he's not getting it.
No.
Not unless he decides to ask for a trade to somewhere. I don't know. San Antonio?
Where?
Yeah. Oklahoma.
Could you picture him in San Antonio?
Kind of, actually.
I don't know. Him and LaMarcus Aldridge.
But he and Pop.
Yes.
He would respect Pop.
That's two guys they'd add that just, this is now completely offered the range of hypothetical. Yeah. Let's trade Patty Mills. Give you Patty Mills at a first.
We've become talk radio.
Yeah.
I think any normal human being, even any normal superstar athlete who had gone through what Kobe's gone through, those three injuries, the shoulder, the knee, the Achilles, would have said, you know what? It's not worth it. This is it. I don't want to go out this way, but my gosh, like, what am I doing to myself? Only Kobe would look at that and say, what? Like, basically, like, F you, Achilles. You're not driving me out of the game. F
it's
you,
like some
shoulder.
Out of Greek mythology.
Like, no, he's like, indeed. No, he's like, he's always been raging against something, defying somebody or something, some idea, something that he couldn't do. Now it's like he's defying his own body. He's basically telling his body, like, you're not the boss of me. I'm going to keep playing. He's 37. He's, and he's an old 37. He's got a ton of miles on him. And he's, not really even at his full health anymore. I don't know that he can still be anything close to what he was. But it's fascinating watching him try. No one's going to attack it harder or more diligently to try to extend this out, to recapture it. I just don't know what he can be at this stage of his career. And what I really want to see for him, as somebody who covered him from his second year in the league through his next 7 years, I want for him the contentment of being able to be what Paul Pierce is now, what Vince Carter's been the last few years, what Grant Hill was at one point. I want Kobe to finally kind of exhale and say, all right, I had my time. I've got all these young kids here. D'Angelo Russell needs some mentoring. Julius Randle needs mentoring. I need to be, I hate that facilitator word because it gets overused, but be out there. He's a really smart player. Kobe knows the right play to make every time. Doesn't always do it because it's the whole trust myself more than others. I'd like to see him just settle into that role where he's just being the elder statesman, still making big shots the way we've seen Paul Pierce do, still taking over at times when necessary, but understanding that, you know, his body's not going to let him be 27-year-old Kobe anymore. And there's a lot of good he can do for that organization and even for his own rep, frankly. And I'll quick aside on this. I think Kobe has turned into almost a caricature of himself where he's fed into all the worst narratives about him. I don't think he is by nature a selfish person or selfish player. I don't think he's a gunner like we think of Allen Iverson as a gunner or some others. Kobe, you know, this is a guy who I've counted it up once and I've quoted it before. He's got more than 82 double-digit assist games in his career, a full season of double-digit assist games. The guy can manufacture a triple-double out of thin air if he wanted to. He knows how to do that. He could go out any night and I'm convinced could do it if he wanted to. Well, maybe not the rebounds anymore, but certainly the points and assists. Be that guy. You know, turn the narrative back around so that people, you don't go out on this note of people thinking that you were the, you know, 37-year-old, you know, three times injured guy who's still trying to gun like he's a 25-year-old. I hate that image of him because I don't think that's truly who he is. And I think it's getting stuck on him in a way that's, you know, not great for him. And
could you see him, you know, Paul Pierce, you mentioned, and Paul Pierce has a ring, but he's obviously in pursuit of one more before his career is over. Kobe's not getting a ring with the Lakers. Not this year, no. Not next year, no. Probably not the year after. It's going to be years before the Lakers are true title contenders. Could you see him signing in the offseason with another team, wearing another jersey to try to get that ring? It's a little different for him than Pierce because five rings is different than one.
Yeah.
And you don't have that same desire, but he does want number six. Put him right up there with Jordan.
Yeah.
Can you see him going to, say, Chicago, Atlanta, one of these teams that is maybe on the brink of winning a championship or being a title contender and could use someone like him?
You know, it's unfortunate in so many ways for the Knicks that they are not closer to title contention, yeah, because the natural move would be to join up with Phil Jackson and Derek Fisher and help that team along. But there's too many moves away from title contention as well. So they're not going to be there. So that would be the natural fit. And he loves that stage. He loves the Garden. Chicago is a place that he'd kind of flirted with before back in, you remember, 2007 when he was threatening wanting to be traded and the Bulls were the front runner for, you know, in theory, at least at that time, that was a place you could see him. And Pau Gasol's there. You know, if Pau's still around in Chicago, could you see Kobe, you know, I think that's, you know, it's got to be like the right team in the right market and with some semblance of people who make sense to Kobe. So maybe, but he really loves the idea too of just like, I'm a 20-year guy with the same organization. I've always been about, as he called it, you know, the golden armor, the purple armor, some kind of armor.
Didn't always, though. Remember, you know, yeah, when he was flirting with the Clippers and the Bulls, there was a one point. That he's older.
Yeah, no, when you get older, that's where the loyalty
legacy
and
starts to matter more.
Yeah, but yeah, when he was younger, yes. In 2004, before he re-signed with the Lakers, he was, you know, in theory, this close to signing with the Clippers. And yeah, there have been some other, like, you know, kind of conceptual flirtations over the years of places that he might have gone or entertained. At this stage, it almost makes more sense just to hang on. But, you know, the other impulse that's hard to quantify is how badly does he want that shot at a sixth ring? Like, you know, we look at Paul Pierce like he's maybe title chasing, but look, Pierce was traded. You know, the Celtics traded him to the Nets. You know, he accepted it, and then he goes to Washington and then the Clippers. He didn't set out to choose this path. He would have been fine staying with Boston until he retired. But once it happened, then it's, okay, I've got a chance to rejoin Doc. You know, it was a place that made sense, and they're contending for a title. If Kobe had that same opportunity, would he? Maybe. How important is the sixth ring? Does it feel as meaningful if you're, you know, riding other people's coattails and you are the fifth, sixth most important person on that roster at best, depending on where you land? I don't know. I don't know if that'd be as satisfying to him. So no, if I had to pick, if I had to predict, I say he retires with the Lakers. And I think probably next summer, I think he wants to get through a season injury free at least. That way he can go out on his own terms and say, all right, I'm good. But man, the dude loves being on the court.
Does. Hard to give up when it's all over. Do you have any team stream stuff to promote while you're here? Do you have any videos you'd like us to check the link to?
So many videos.
Clickbait.
They're all at least.
Beck versus Bucher.
Stop. I've won every single one of those, by the way. There are many, many, many videos on Bleacher Report right now that you can see. We've got a whole bunch of previews going on. And I'll have a feature on Kevin Durant up on the site and the app on, I think, Wednesday.
The app? We don't have an app. Where's our app?
Don't get me started.
We're behind.
Don't get me started on your app. I already gave Dollinger an earful.
Well, Beck, you are officially my number one in-studio podcast guest.
Meaning no one else is
no one
to
else
come
has
into
come
this.
In here to the yeah. studio. Yeah, that's yeah. right.
I'm the guy who goes in. I like hanging out in, you know, studios with bare walls and, you know, I was promised hair product actually. Dollinger promised me
it's coming. I'm in preseason form.
Signature
I'm
line.
Still in preseason form.
I can see that. It's really
it's
sad.
It's coming. But thanks for coming in, my friend.
Thanks for having me.
That's gonna do it for this week's episode of the Open Floor Podcast. Thanks to Kyle Lowry, Howard Beck, and Mark Bechtel for joining us on the show. You can find more great Sports Illustrated podcasts at si.com/podcast, and please subscribe to us on iTunes. Remember to tweet me at ChrisManixSI or my producer, Alan Kim, at AlanXKim, and use the hashtag OpenFloor to have your voice heard. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.